Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I'm delighted again to be able to host the third Macro Investing Masterclass with two distinguished capital markets experts, namely Chris Watling, CEO of Longview Economics, and Edmund Ching, CIO of BNP Paribas Wealth Management. So welcome, gents.
Welcome. Thank you very much, Paul.
Well, we've had a lot happening again over the last 4 weeks, not least actually, sort of like stronger than expected US payrolls and inflation prints out in the States. And that's sort of driven up interest rate expectations, or certainly on bond yields, both sides of the Atlantic. So just starting there, Chris, putting all that together, what's your latest view for equities for the rest of the year?
Yeah, I mean, well, we've been in a sort of enduring relief rally. To be honest, it depends where you look in the world on how well equities have done. I mean, quite a lot of markets have been flat since early February. You know, they whooshed up in January. They were quite strong into early Feb. And actually, outside of tech, there hasn't been a lot of action, except actually in the last couple of days. So, I mean, if you look at a lot of the European markets, they're flat since early Feb. I mean, the S&P is basically flat since early Feb, apart from the last 2 or 3 days. When the market has broadened out, but really it's primarily this year has been a sort of 10 stock gain, 5 stock gains. I know we're going to talk about AI later, but you know, outside of that, it's really interesting to me. The cyclical sectors in aggregate have really struggled, and I think there's a message in there. I mean, they generally do when money's getting tighter. So what do I think about the rest of the year? I think, you know, I like to think about the market as three things. It's tech and long duration growth stocks. It's cyclicals and it's defensives, you know, the very top level. I mean, defensives going through, defensive never lead the market higher. Tech, I think, is toppy, at least for now. And cyclicals don't rally much when money's getting tighter. So I think the market's going down in the second half.
Well, just on that one, if you are cautious, given that the VIX is sort of 14, 15, just for professional investors, is this sort of like an opportune moment to consider sort of like getting downside protection and say put options here, because the pricing for these things must be pretty, pretty tight.
Yeah, it's cheap. And actually, if you look at, there's this ratio called the skew ratio, which is like the VIX, but it's basically buying deep out of the money put options. So big protection against a big plunge in the market. And we've seen it, and actually professional investors use it, and it tends to be a good indication of when they're really getting worried about life, and actually can be quite predictive at times. And it's picked up aggressively in the last few weeks, actually. So nervousness is building. You know, if you want to buy deep out the money put protection, it's getting more expensive. Near term, not much out of the money isn't expensive because of the VIX, as you say. So yeah. So it's getting pretty interesting out there, I think.
Right, good. Now, Edmund, what are sort of your takeaways for the sort of the Q1 earnings seasons, along with the sort of like the sort of self-healing position on the banks? Because now that seems to be off the sort of front page that we're getting a bank explosion every day.
Well, it's interesting because if we look at the quarter one results, they've actually been much better, I would have said, than people would have thought. Particularly in Europe. So in the US, they were better than people expected. Margins have held up better. which is a bit of a surprise because we know inflation, you know, there is cost inflation. But inflation, don't forget, Paul, is a double-edged sword. Yes, costs go up, but it's also allowed companies to raise prices. So in the end, while consumers have suffered, it seems that companies as of yet have not really suffered. If anything, it benefited slightly. I mean, okay, it depends which sectors we're talking about, but in the main, in aggregate, we can say that companies have actually benefited by putting prices up. And there is this economist, Isabella Weber, who talks about this, you know, this sort of generalized inflation push coming to a large extent from companies who are hiding behind the very high levels of inflation to put up prices. And of course, that in itself has perpetuated higher inflation because then prices go up again. Now, I don't think this is going to last forever because we are seeing demand cooling. You know, if you look at retail sales in the US, it's still actually pretty okay. But I think there are some signs of cooling, I'm sure Chris will talk about. In Europe, definitely there are signs of cooling of retail sales if you look at Germany in particular or France, linked to the very high food inflation. But I think that as a result of all of this, companies have done very well so far in Q1. Probably the rest of the year, it's going to be difficult to hang on to these very levels of high margin, because for one thing, they're not going to be able to push through further price increases, in my view, and they still have to absorb the wage increases. So let's see. So I think that actually could be quite good for consumption if you have this mixture of inflation coming down, wage increases still in the system. Because remember, once it's done for the year, let's say you have a wage agreement in Germany for the year, it is for the year. So you actually have a higher salary level for the rest of the year. And you may get this crossover where inflation comes down, wage inflation is still, you know, higher than it has been for many years. And so you actually get a positive real income effect, which would eventually support consumption. And one other point about consumption is that in particularly in Europe, people have not spent the excess savings they built up over COVID. Yeah. They've spent some, maybe about half in the US. I mean, there are different numbers floating around, but I think half is seems about right to me. But in Europe, very little has actually been spent, which means that if inflation comes down and consumers get a little bit more confident about the outlook, then in fact, they have plenty of potential to spend. And that will be good for companies, particularly in retail.
You've got to be careful with those numbers, I always think, because it kind of depends how you think about them. I mean, think about them relative to nominal GDP growth. And, you know, getting back to trend, I'd say both those are much more advanced, actually. You can make an argument in the US that they're pretty much tapped out now, give them a couple more months. And in Europe, they're not that far behind. So it's interesting what you say about the consumer, because I think there's very strong signs that at the margin in the States, they're really starting to deteriorate. We've just been looking at this the last few days. There's lots of little things going on. And of course, we had a lot of companies sort of starting to allude to that, you know, the sort of Dollar Generals and the Macy's at sort of different ends of the scale and so on. And interesting as well, if you look at retail sales or you look at service sector spending, I mean, in the US, service sector spending looks like the sort of last piece of the puzzle that's still quite strong. But actually, the reason it's so strong is because of rent going up, you know, the rents are going up and utility bills. If you strip that out, actually, the other discretionary stuff isn't so good at all. And I don't think you're that far behind.
Yeah, you're right. And there's another very interesting phenomenon, particularly in financial services inflation. Because as you said, in services inflation, there's actually quite a big lump of financial services. And within financial services, a lot of that is financing, like in leases, which, of course, are going up because the Fed's raised interest rates. So, you know, there's a good argument that at least in that part of service inflation, the Fed has raised interest rates and they're doing the exact opposite of what they want. Instead of bringing inflation down, they're actually the ones inflating the prices, at least in the short term, which is quite amusing when you think about it, because they really are shooting themselves in the foot.
Yes, they're spatting against themselves.
Yeah,
exactly.
There does seem to be sort of quite a lot of strikes just in the UK. So I think a lot of that wage inflation at the moment is quite entrenched. I mean, I did see the Heathrow workers going off on a strikes over the summer and they wouldn't accept 7% increase. So we've probably got to bear that. But just also, Edmund, just in terms of the banking crisis, is that now over, other than the reality that regulation's coming in? Because it has been mooted that you know, effectively Congress is going to sort of mandate that US banks are going to hold 20% sort of capital ratios up from, I don't know what it is, probably around about 14, 15, which would be a major drag on income investors and dividends.
Yeah, I think It's a little bit unfair in the US because if you look at the globally systemically important banks like the Citigroups and the JP Morgans, they already have fairly tight, they have really quite tight regulation already. They have to hold a lot of capital against their businesses, just as in Europe. The problem has been that regional banks had a laxer policy. So rather than saying everyone should raise, should hold 20%, it would seem to be more logical to say, well, maybe we should treat regional banks in the same way we are already treating globally systemic banks and just bring up that bar so you have a level playing field, first of all, because that always seemed to me a bit bizarre. And that was, I think, one of the real problems which has lain behind the regional banking problems that we've seen. Having said that, the weakest players have been taken out. I don't think it's over. I think it's more of a slow burn. Maybe we've had the first shock, but we're going to have the slow burn effect, which will continue and drag down the economy. We see this in the senior loan officer survey in terms of bank lending. We've already talked about this, but it's slowing and it will continue to slow because banks are having to think about, their deposits and therefore think about their loans as a ratio to deposits. They can't keep lending if they can't even keep a hold of the deposits. Now, the good news is that bank run, where deposits were running out of bank deposit accounts into money market funds, that seems to have slowed quite considerably. Mm. Of course, partly because banks have just jacked up their interest rates. So they said, in an effort to keep money in deposit accounts, a lot of the weaker regional banks have had to say, well, we have to offer higher deposit rates.
Yeah.
Right. So we compete. They have to compete with money market funds, which is of course hurting their near-term profitability. But I think at the moment, that's normal.
Okay.
And actually the big banks like Citi and JP Morgan aren't doing that. They don't need to do it. They don't need the deposits. They don't have a problem. Yeah. If they lose a bit of deposit, for them it's not a problem. It's only really a problem for the regional banks right now.
Okay. So it sounds like it's still work in progress. So putting all that together, Chris, in terms of bonds, I mean, the sort of phrase du jour is bonds are back. If we're going to have a softer economic environment for the rest of the year, is that going to be bullish for bonds? And if so, where to play it along the sort of the curve, the duration, or is it credit or sovereigns, Europe or the States? Plenty of options.
Yeah. Plenty of options. Well, I mean, the thing for a UK investor, of course, is you've got to think about your currency exposure once you start going overseas. But that's a different question. But in terms of bonds, yeah, I mean, what really matters for bonds is what's going to happen to inflation and what's going to happen to growth and monetary policy. What's the central bank going to get up to? And I think there's a very good argument that inflation is going to come down faster than people expect. Looks pretty, for lots of reasons, not least the fact that money supply is contracting in most countries of the world now, on a sort of 6-month rate of change or 12-month rate of change. So money's really getting tight. And actually, if you look at inflation, it's quite interesting. There's quite a few shocks in there that are going to dissipate pretty fast. I mean, the UK is a great case in point. Household electricity bills, energy bills are up at 90% year on year just a few months ago. They're now running at sort of 30%, and they'll be negative in 6, 9, 12 months. So the very big, it's not a big weighting, but it's a very big percentage and it has a big impact on the numbers. So those sort of things, food prices, if you look at international food prices, they're down. So all of that, I think, and growth and recessions that are coming, all of that means bonds are pretty attractive. What's the best way to play it? Well, I would say long duration. You can go short duration, you get the yield, but you might as well stick your money in money market fund if you can access it, depending on where you are in the world, or something equivalent. But if you want more than that, you can get the yield and the capital gain by going longer duration. And I would go govies or investment grade. I wouldn't go lower down the capital structure than that because it's riskier, basically.
I would certainly say definitely, as Chris said, definitely do not go to high yield because the high yield spreads do not compensate you for the risk that's in front of you if we go into recession. Absolutely.
Yeah. And is there any issue in terms of now with the debt ceiling in the US has cleared? We've got this sort of like potential mountain of issuance in US treasuries, about $1 trillion, I've been told, for the rest of the year. Is that going to impact yields? Sort of like you get this deluge of selling, essentially. And somebody's got to mop it up, and therefore that's going to artificially push up effectively the bonds.
I think it's more likely to impact equities because perversely, what you're doing is you're soaking up financial market liquidity. And the first place they will get soaked up from is the equity market. So if equities struggle, then bonds will do well, even though there's a lot of issuance.
So it does sound as
And I would say, Paul, just to add to that, that there are lots of technical issues. For instance, what maturity of bond does the US Treasury decide to issue? Short term, medium term, long term? I would guess shorter term. And if so, so short term that even they could be taken by money market funds? Because there's a lot of reverse repo that's held effectively by money market funds. They could, instead of holding these reverse repo instruments, hold these short-term bills, in which case there will be less of a liquidity hit. The problem is we just don't know. It depends on the timing of the issuance, and it depends on the maturity and what money market funds do. Do they absorb some of this or not? So there are a lot of unknowns, but I would be with Chris. I think it's certainly... It certainly could threaten technology stocks, because if you look at the flows in the US, the only sector to have big flows, and they were, if you look at the Bank of America data, monster flows over the last month, it has been in tech, as you would expect, right? The momentum has attracted huge money, and we haven't seen a monthly flow into tech stocks as big as what we've seen in the last month since early 2021. Yeah. And I think if the liquidity dries up, you're sitting on high valuations, you've just had massive inflows, that could be the first place to suffer.
Yeah. Well, that brings beautifully then into your expertise area here, Edmund. Mm. We're going to leverage your PhD in AI again, because when we talked about this subject briefly last time, we were all a bit cautious and neutral on NVIDIA because of the valuation, even though the growth. And then they knocked the ball out of the park and the shares were up 25% on the day.
Yeah.
So what's your latest view in terms of playing this sort of mania almost in sort of certainly FOMO effect in AI?
Oh no, it's definitely a FOMO effect. I would agree with that. And it's it's concentrated in very few stocks as well. That's the funny thing. I mean, it's, as you say, apart from the Nvidia, which is the obvious winner, then you're talking about the Microsoft, Googles and so on. They're all up as a group 50-odd% year to date, which is massive. And certainly has been the power behind the momentum on the NASDAQ 100. I think if I look at artificial intelligence, obviously it's very exciting. Is it the next big thing? No, it is the big thing. Absolutely, I believe. I believe that to be the case. Do we know who the winners are going to be? Not really. It's still too early to tell. Obviously, NVIDIA will do well out of it for now. But again, we don't know for how long. The problem with technology, Paul, as I like to remind everyone, is that technology can be disrupted itself by even newer disruptive technology. So yes, NVIDIA may be at the vanguard of this disruptive AI technology today, but let's say quantum computing were to come along in a few years. That could just blow NVIDIA out of the ground. That could be the next big thing. Yeah. We just don't know. And with the evaluations, the level of expected growth baked into NVIDIA for the next umpteen years, it's really quite extraordinary. That's what always worries me. And it does contain echoes of what happened with, let's say, Cisco Systems at the height of the sort of the internet bubble mania in 1999-2000. We're sort of back in a similar sort of territory. Maybe the valuations are not quite as extreme, but we're sort of getting there. And so I would say, if you want to play artificial intelligence, think about the sectors and companies that could benefit. As we mentioned before, healthcare is an obvious one, which could clearly benefit from huge changes in business model and a huge improvement in productivity brought around by machine learning and artificial intelligence. For instance, in reading of x-rays, effectively, very simply, you embed the best expertise of the best radiologists in an artificial intelligence system. They learn from the best radiologists. And once they've captured that knowledge, they can perform, and this has been shown, that they can read x-rays and detect, let's say, cancerous tumors, as well as the best radiologists, except the difference here is you could put one computer in every hospital in the entire world, in theory, so you could replicate the pooled expert knowledge of these top radiologists and distribute it around the hospitals all over the world. So you would eliminate the variation in accuracy of reading x-rays that we have today, because we use human radiologists. Everyone makes mistakes, right? So they have varying degrees of accuracy and expertise, whereas you could level the playing field at the top with very good expertise on a broad scale with AI. And I think healthcare is one area, with diagnostics. Another area would be education. We come back to the whole point of education. I think it'd be hugely disruptive in education, because you could say, let's take the top professors from MIT, Oxford, Cambridge, or wherever, right? And let's be clear, Paul, they're very expensive if you want to go and study at these universities. And for me, the level of teaching is not great, because these guys might be fantastic for research.
We've all come through university, haven't we?
Well, we have. So we will have first-hand experience. You know what
I'm talking about. We agree.
Yeah, they can be brilliant professors for research purposes, but they sort of come grudgingly to give lectures because that's part of the job. But that's not what they want to do. Yeah. They're not really going to give their whole body and soul to it. Whereas maybe an AI tutor could deliver similar content in a much better fashion on a personalized basis.
Yeah.
And this idea of personalized learning using AI tutors and AI learning and AI system to teach could be far more effective than in a wide lecture hall setting or a classroom setting where, you know, the teacher or the professor has to sort of set a level and pitch to that level, which does not evidently suit either maybe the brightest or the least able students. Whereas with an AI tutor, you go at the speed of the student. Mm. So I think that could be massively disruptive, massively powerful for education. So, I mean, those are just two ideas. Yeah. We haven't even talked about industrial automation.
We haven't talked about,
there are just so many applications here. One interesting idea here, Paul, is that one of the sectors that could be disrupted the most could be technology itself. Because the latest disruptive technology, AI, what could it disrupt? It could disrupt, for instance, IT services. Because a lot of IT services are effectively what we call body shopping. You're supplying, people with an intermediate level of experience in programming or IT systems. Yeah. Well, that's exactly the sort of segment that could come under pressure from advanced AI systems.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to carry on asking the same question every single month there, Edmund, so you have to keep us up to date. But I'm with you in terms of, we just first commented with NVIDIA. I think it trades now at about 23 times sales, and the market does get sort of like ahead of itself in terms of extrapolating historical growth or near-term growth for 20 years and think it's going to continue. Now, just moving on to sort of practical perspective for investors, Chris, how can we integrate sort of AI into our investing strategy here? Because you're at the sort of sharp end of the sort of like what you see in the capital markets with algo trading and this sort of stuff. But equally, you could see it put into the wealth management side with likes of Edmund, where it helps the CIOs make better investment decisions for their clients. How do you see it, Chris?
Well, I mean, there's all this chat from JP Morgan, isn't there, at the moment? They're developing an AI system to help them do asset allocation.
It was banned.
Well, I don't think they've launched it. I'm just saying, I think they're looking into it and they've been investigating it. I've got a client who gets ChatGPT to write some of his investment stuff. I mean, I think in terms of, Edmund articulated very well, AI can do a lot of stuff. In markets or elsewhere. I think the stock market itself, though, has got way ahead of itself on this whole AI trade. I mean, as Edmund articulated, yes, you want to buy the picks and shovels, but no one knows who the winner's going to be. And I think what happens in markets like this is you get towards the end of these sort of long, it's a bit like a long, stale bull market, if you like. I know we had a bear market last year, but, it's a bit like 1999, 2000. You can't put money in cyclicals because the economy's slowing. You don't buy defensive. So the liquidity goes somewhere and it goes into all that's left, that is tech. And tech just happens to have a great story at the moment. And what happens is everyone, that story gets amplified. And then, I was in New York 2 months ago. Everyone was telling me to buy AI because I reckon it's pretty simple. Goldman's have been running around New York telling everyone to buy AI because the stocks have gone up a lot. So they've worked out, I think NVIDIA's new chip was November last year, I believe, wasn't it? That was the beginning of the move. We're now a long way through this move, I'd say. It's certainly the first chapter of it. So for me, the market can only deal with one debate in front of itself. And it's been AI for a bit, but it's really going to get back to the economy, I think, in the next few weeks or months. The market's starting to look a little bit toppy, I'd say. Maybe it's got a few more weeks in it, but
in the capital markets, the actual usage. Does the likes of Longview Economics or your clients actively use AI to help their sort of short term, high frequency trading? And if so, what sort of like examples is it? Is it sort of like really big, deep, liquid markets for short duration? I mean, how do people see it?
No, I think clients use AI. I don't know exactly what they do. But I suspect, they use it to help them improve their trading models, potentially. I mean, not my clients, but you read about some of the bigger hedge funds, maybe Citadel, who have embedded AI teams to improve the way they operate, to improve their trading system. I don't think this is, in a way, this is probably not that new. It's just a sort of an advancement, an iteration of really what they've been doing for years. You think about Renaissance Technologies and Jim Simons, isn't it? Who, James Simons or Simons. I mean, it's incredible what they've been doing for decades. And I guess, you know, Edmund would know more, but I wonder if in a way AI is very new, but in a way it's a development as well of what's been going on for a long time, in a sense,
of the chapter. I would absolutely right, Chris. I mean, it's been around for a long time. I mean, as I said, I did my PhD eons ago, so it's been around. But and we've had yes, of course, the computer power necessary has improved exponentially year after year after year. But as you say, enough computing power has been around for long enough that hedge funds and institutions have been able to use AI learning models, particularly for things like high frequency and algorithmic trading, because the name of the game is always to get to find an edge in this sort of high frequency trading. And what has always been known for years and years is that if you find an edge, it's not going to last. You know, it lasts a few months. And so you obviously squeeze the lemon while you can and get every drop out of it. But sure as eggs are eggs, sooner or later, these trading models lose their alpha. Because again, you know, everything, the market adapts. And there are better algos out there that supersede them. So it is always a bit like an arms race in high frequency trading to find the next best model to generate that little fraction of alpha time over many, many trades. And AI has been implemented for many years along those lines to try and find the next model. The problem always with AI learning models, by the way, Paul, is that you need to be able to explain the results. And this is always what people forget. A lot of these things like neural networks are effectively like black box models. They may come up with great, you put stuff in one end, interesting results come out the other end. But then if you have to explain, how did you get from the inputs to the outputs? Well, you can't, because you don't actually know how it's done it. I mean, it's very sophisticated pattern recognition. Okay, great. How did it do it? How do you explain how you got from the inputs to the outputs? And if you can't, who's going to have any confidence in the model? Even if it looks like a great model statistically, it's very difficult to have confidence in it if you can't explain how the damn thing works.
Yeah, the expression I've heard from many sort of hedge funds or traders is we're rules-based. That's been the best explanation.
Which means they can't explain further than that. So they just hope no one asks the question.
I know. Now, just moving to the over to the east in the geographical sense, Chris, in terms of China, what are you seeing there? Because obviously they're the world's second biggest economy. Everybody had high hopes at the start of the year that it was going to drive this sort of commodity super cycle. Oil sort of soared off the back of it. And then in April and May today, we do seem to see the economy spluttering in terms of, you know, exports and consumer consumption. What's your sort of latest view? Is this just a sort of like a soft patch and then we're going ahead, or is this more sort of like serious?
Well, look, I mean, China's in a completely different place in terms of its economic cycle. As we know, it reopened later. It's got different monetary policy. It's playing a different game, but it's just not wasting away. And it's, in a way, it's not really surprising, because one, they don't want to re-leverage the economy. And really the only way China's grown in the last decade is by re-leveraging and building a lot of stuff and getting house prices up. And secondly, that, you know, the housing market is somewhat broken and they don't want house prices up a lot. So they've got this weird economy where, you know, actually, if you think about it, they've had 2 years of lockdown without much fiscal support. So there's a whole bunch of migrant workers who don't even get included in the stats, and they don't have jobs.
That's surprising.
They've been unemployed for 2 years. there's gazillions of them. They don't get included. They haven't had a job. They haven't earned money for 2 years. And so, you know, there's a lot of cash in bank accounts, but that's really with the few and the sort of middle class. But there's a whole heap, a ton of people who are really struggling. And of course, you know, migrant workers, you know, they provide services, but they also work a lot in the industrial sector of the economy, and global industrial sector is slowing. So, you know, housing's not firing, infrastructure's not happening, global industrial sector's weak. Yes, there's money in bank accounts. That's why, you know, China's just not reaccelerating hard. It will recover, I'm sure, because they will ensure it recovers, and they don't have any inflation. So they don't have to worry about where interest rates are, they can cut them. So, I they've made it pretty clear, the policymakers, they'll backstop the recovery. But what you won't see is, this is not 2009 when China saves the world. And this is not 2015-16 when they pretty much did that again. So it's a very, as I like to say, it's not your father's China. It's right. Not your father's Chinese recovery. It's pretty tepid.
Yeah. Edmund, what do you think Beijing will do in terms of, because there's lots of talk that they're going to effectively push that stimulus button in the property sector because they see essentially local GDP, state GDP going down.
Well, I think they will. I agree with Chris. They don't want to obviously incite another property bubble. But my feeling is confidence has been damaged. Really, under the waterline, as it were. It's really been holed under the waterline in terms of investing in property for the sort of Chinese middle class. And remember, this has been the go-to asset class for the Chinese middle class to invest in for over a decade, right? And it's been very simple. Why? Because prices just went up and up and up, double digit, pretty much year after year after year. So why wouldn't you bet on that? It was like, as you say, as my father always says, can't go wrong with bricks and mortar, And so this was, of course, was the mantra that's been damaged. And I don't think confidence is going to come back. And that's probably a good thing, really, because as Chris said, the one thing the Chinese government don't want is property prices to go up again a lot. Yeah. Because they are already pretty unaffordable for first-time buyers. And so, again, along the lines of the common prosperity goals that the Chinese Communist Party are pushing, obviously they would like to stabilize the property sector. Yeah, okay. They don't want prices to keep going down because that's very bad for the economy, bad for jobs. But so they've got this tightrope to walk where they can allow prices to rise a little bit, but not a lot. So broadly stable, I think, is what they're looking for. And I think they will inject stimulus, and they're already putting pressure on banks to lend more money again, to they probably will lower interest rates again because they can, because as Chris said, they don't have inflation like we have. Yeah. And I think they will do that. So I do think the recovery will come, but I think it is quite spotty at the moment. It is based much more on consumption than manufacturing, clearly. And that's partly because we in the West are not buying as many goods post-COVID. We had that boom when lockdowns ended, but that boom in goods consumption is over. However, I do think there are two sectors we can concentrate on. One is anything to do with renewable energy. Because remember, 80% plus of solar panels in the world are produced where? In China. A lot of the processing of the critical battery metals like lithium needed for electric batteries, for solar panels are processed where? In China. Yeah. So I think anything to do with the energy transition and renewable energy, particularly around solar panels and electric batteries, is going to be very big for China in terms of export. Second area, of course, electric vehicles. Did you know China has become the biggest vehicle exporter in the world ahead of Germany by number of cars? Maybe not by value, but by number of cars. And I think they haven't even come to Europe yet. I cannot see the BYD remember there are about 40 odd electric vehicle manufacturers in China led by BYD.
They do. BYD, they do an electric MG around Birmingham, I can promise you.
They do. Well. But I think what you look at, where the big success has been in China, has actually been in micro cars, smart car, two-seater sort of size, really small cars, which don't need a massive range because they just go around the city. And, those could potentially be sold for maybe, who knows, £4,000 or £5,000. Completely different price point to the Teslas or any of the other electric vehicle full-scale models we have today.
Yeah.
And that could be what really drives Chinese exports and what really drives demand for electric vehicles, just introducing this new price point.
Yeah. So, Chris, in terms of, we were pretty good positive thesis on the sort of super cycle, industrial metals and all that kind of stuff last time. What's your sort of view now in terms of baking in that sort of like China, Beijing will stabilize the situation, but probably won't want to juice it up?
Well, I mean, we still like the commodities super cycle. It's just, I always say it goes in chapters. It's not a straight line. If you look in the 1970s or whenever, there's tons of commodity super cycles. We looked at them back to the 1700s. They go, 1 year, a different type of commodity does well each year. So this is the year for precious metals. That's been our view. And energy and cyclical stuff, cyclical metals, you want to buy in the pullback. So yeah, you're right. Copper's been pretty soft recently. So's iron ore. So's oil. I mean, just look at the Saudis are batting hard to try and support the oil price. But the market's saying, we don't care.
What's your view on the sort of the dark stuff at the moment? Because as you say, they've reducing their oil production by about 1 million barrels, etc. But Russia seems to be still sort of getting its crude out through the markets into places like India and China, I guess.
Oil's amazing, isn't it? I mean, we've been bearish on oil since post-Ukraine because the view at the time was Russian supplies are going to dry up. You know, they're cut by 3 or 4 million barrels per day. But that's all been coming out. You can see it in the tankers. You can track the tankers coming out of the ports. And you can see, I mean, the sort of joke is if you look at Malaysian exports of oil, it's about 4 times what they actually, you know, produce. So I mean, it's just, you know, it's like the 70s. The oil gets out. It always gets out, even if there are sanctions. You know, it's fungible. It doesn't matter. So the supply's there, and the world economy's slowing. I mean, I hear reports of orders books falling sharply in the last few weeks, couple of months, in certain parts of the world, and that's a classic sign of the industrial sector really coming under pressure, and that, you know, that impacts oil demand as well, you know, and so I wouldn't buy oil yet, but I think having been bearish for about a year, we're getting to that time. There is a floor, you know, and there's, you know, we're not a million miles away from it. So we just need everyone to be bearish. Once everyone's bearish, then you want to go the other way. That's the rule of thumb.
So what's your view, Edmund, in terms of sort of the commodity stocks, the miners and the oil boys, sort of like the big integrates?
Again, in the short term, obviously the recession concerns are what are dominating, and that's what's keeping, just as it's keeping the oil price and the price of copper under wraps, obviously same impact on the mining stocks. But I'm with Chris. I'm a huge believer in the commodity super cycle. Again, just take the example of copper. If we really are going to ensure an energy transition, I mean, really, and really invest so much in renewable energy, the amount of copper you need, think about this. Every solar farm, every wind turbine needs to be connected to the grid, right? So before, think about this, you would have had a few big, you know, power generation centers, stations, whether it be gas, coal, oil, nuclear, whatever. But you just had a few big blocks. You'd do most of the generation. Then you had obviously a huge cable going to the grid, and then it'd be spread to homes and factories. Now, very different. You have lots of micro generation outlets coming from the solar panels, coming from wind turbines, and so on. So you need a lot more copper because suddenly the network you need feeding into the grid is a lot denser. You know, a lot more cables feeding into the grid as well as out. Mm-hmm. So to me, copper demand, and we haven't even talked about electric cars, which typically have roughly about 4 times as much copper content as a petrol or diesel engine car. You know, you're just talking about massive demand for copper over the next 20, 30 years. Where are the new mines? There aren't any. In fact, there haven't been any big new discoveries for quite a long time.
They're being nationalized in Chile, aren't they?
They're
being nationalized in Chile.
Well, and this is the point. The second point is that, you know, we have OPEC for oil. Well, cartels are being formed for critical battery metals like lithium, copper, you know, and of course, the fact that Russian's being sanctioned doesn't help. If you want, you want nickel, good luck, because Norilsk Nickel is Russian. It's the biggest producer in the world. So suddenly, the pressure's on. And as I say, Indonesia doing the same thing with tin, right? You think tin, who cares about tin? Tin is the solder used in everything that's electronic, everything. And you have a lot of tin content in electric cars, in solar panels, computers, smartphones, you name it, there's tin, right? And how many suppliers? Do you know how many listed suppliers there are, producers there are? Very, very, very few.
There's a small one in Cornwall, I think.
That doesn't even produce it. Don't start with Cornish tin. That does. I mean, in terms of producers, as opposed to pie in the sky projects, But there are very few. You know, and so I look at things like that, and I think, we could get like an OPEC style cartel for these critical battery metals based around, for instance, Latin American producers like Chile, Peru, and so on, and Mexico, and that could really jack up the prices overnight because we know that we know what the demand looks like. If you get constraints on supply like that, and with the lack of new mines as well, like, it's a pretty spicy cocktail.
Yeah. Well, it's, that does sound as though if you've got a long-term view, people like Rio Tinto, we've got that big copper mine out in Chile, or half, and I think BNP as well or some. But anyway, those would be, is it, I think Anglo-American as well has got big copper exposure. Mm. So something to have, people have a look at. Now, Chris, just in terms of sort of like the health of the consumer, I know you're pretty bearish on it. I mean, are you selling everything in consumer, even the sort of high end now, or what's your sort of outlook for it?
Well, consumer, I mean, they're under a lot of pressure, aren't they? So, I think our outlook is it's challenged. You know, it's all about getting to the edge of that unemployment curve. And we just sort of, it just like looks like the slope might be starting to shift up. I mean, if you look at non-farm payrolls in the States last month, the actual unemployment rate went up quite a bit. I mean, the headline employment number was pretty good, but the unemployment rate was up. And who knows which is a better indicator? I have my misgivings about NFP and about the payrolls number. So, I think the consumer is cracking. As I said, if you look at look at someone's discretionary spending, it's under pressure. Look at consumers, they're trading down. We see that in the UK. They're going to the cheap supermarkets. They're not going to the expensive ones. People are running out of money. And the lower incomes have definitely run out of money. Middle incomes are starting to run out of money. And look, don't get me wrong. I mean, some of the markets are pretty cheap in the West outside the States. And there will be very good opportunities in small and mid caps because a lot of those indices are already cheap. So these are sort of things you want to pick up in weakness in the stock market. But the cracks are growing. We put out a piece yesterday. The cracks are emerging in the US consumer.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, you've just led me briefly into Edmund, into sort of like small and mid-cap stocks, because, I mean, I've been a reluctant bear up until the last couple of months, sort of like over the last, you know, sort of year or so. But now I'm a bit more bullish just on valuation grounds, even though I'm with you, the economics are looking a bit deteriorating, certainly from the back end of this year and probably into next year. But given the small and my, you know, sort of more mid-caps, Edmund, what's your sort of view there? Because valuations are absolutely battered.
They are, Paul. They are. And I would say, again, for the long term, it's getting extremely interesting. But you need to be a bit of a contrarian investor at the moment, because you need to hold your nose and buy and wait for the cycle to bottom. And as Chris said, in a sense, the cycle hasn't bottomed yet, you know. But again, if inflation comes down and if wage growth holds up, consumption could start to rebound. You know, at some point, maybe it takes a bit longer in the UK. The rest of Europe might actually rebound a bit quicker, in my view. I think the UK is a bit of a special situation because inflation is quite a bit stickier, and I do put part of the blame at Brexit's door for that. But it is a bit stickier on the downside. But I think it'll come down, and I think ultimately that will be better news for consumption. But away from consumption, I would say now is the time, given the, as you said, the low valuations that really are everywhere, even in the US. Mid and small caps are far, far cheaper than the big caps. Very much true as well in Europe and the UK. And I think you go hunting around, and you can afford to be choosy. You can afford to go for relatively high return on capital companies that have a bit of growth in there over the long term, good management, hopefully management with skin in the game, so that, you know, either as a founder, family, or the directors have, you know, sizable shareholdings, and those sorts of companies I like, because you can get a lot of them at really relatively low valuations right now, and you can buy quality. You don't have to buy just everything. You can buy quality. So I would say it's very much a case. It is a stock picker's market. It's because you don't want to be in small caps. You really don't want to be buying indices if you can help it, because you unfortunately buy a lot of stuff you don't really want to buy effectively when you buy ETFs. So I would say it's very much a stock picker's market. But I think there are lots of very interesting opportunities out there in the UK, and the UK in particular, actually. The UK, I find, a particular value market, and particularly in the small and mid caps.
Yeah. And also, I think if we're right in terms of bond yields eventually coming down because interest rates will, that's certainly over the last 18 months probably been one of the biggest headwinds for small and mid caps, is that cost of capital. And if the cost of capital can be reduced, then that'll improve your multiples on your small caps, even if the outlook is not great. Now, just for sort of finishing off, though, Chris, what's your sort of views on the currency movements in terms of, because I mean, you've got sort of like the dollar, which is sort of like pretty static against cable, but it has strengthened against the euro actually just recently.
Yeah. Look, I think the dollar's due a rally. It's been going down for 6 months and everyone's become very bearish. That's a pretty good sign, it's due a rally. So I wouldn't be jumping on sterling here against the dollar. Against the euro, you're sort of arguing the toss. I never think it's I wouldn't expect too much serious. I think the main action's in the dollar and over the next few months. Having said that, you know, you look out beyond that. It's the age of the non-dollar currencies. That's the next 3 to 5 years. Back to the point about if you're a long-term investor, you're patient, pick up sterling on weakness and sell the dollar or you know, whichever non-dollar currency you like. I think, I mean, it obviously depends where you're denominated, what your base currency is. But, you know, I think the dollar's going to have a tough 5 years, but not yet. We're not, not there yet, I'm afraid. It's, tempting to say we are, but we're not. And, we've actually seen, you look at the dollar, it's base building. It's been base building for 3 or 4 months. It's trying to rally and it looks like it's going to do that.
Yeah. No, I think if you're right and there's going to be a bit of a recession, then it's going to strengthen short term before it, you know, sort of like suck liquidity out. Now, just finally, Edmund, in terms of what you're looking for over the like next month, what's sort of like on the Shing radar for sort of like things which could really move the dial?
Goodness me, that's a very good question.
Well again, interest rates out the Fed in a couple of weeks.
Do you know what? I would come back to something boring, which I think is underappreciated, which Chris has already mentioned, in fact, which is my personal conviction is that inflation rates will come down much faster than people expect and sooner than people expect. And we could even start to see the signs of that really occurring. And we are seeing it in Europe. We could see it continue in next month. And I think the really big element I would look within that, because what's really hurting people is food inflation. It's been sticky. It is coming off the top, but we could really see some big acceleration downwards, even if for no other reason, just a comparison, you know, like a 12-month. Yeah, if you look at 12 months ago, food prices had already been rising quite a lot. So at some point, inevitably, arithmetically speaking, the year-on-year comparison will look more favorable. But I do think that, as Chris said, a lot of people are trading away. They are going to Lidl and Aldi and not shopping and not buying the Nestle or the Unilever brands. So they are trading down and buying own brand product. And so that in itself should feed through eventually. The problem is, of course, that these basket compositions for inflation are very slow to change. So we don't necessarily see that impact fully reflected in the official CPI numbers. Mm. But I think it's there, and I think it will accelerate. And I think actually that can be very good for the bond market in particular, but better for, that might even help the economy. Moderate any recession.
Yeah. So if you do get that base effects on inflation and it comes down sharply, is it going to stay down if you don't crack the labour market, which I think is the point that Chris is making?
Yeah, I mean, the labour market's an interesting one because I would agree with Chris that some, particularly in the US, the statistics are quite confusing. Because you, of course, as we said, between unemployment and non-farm payrolls, they're actually based on two completely different surveys. And they're telling us, they're giving us different answers at the moment. So it's a bit confusing. But if we look at other indicators of, let's say, the US employment market, it clearly points to weakening of the momentum. Companies are telling us that the Fed, the Atlanta Fed wage tracking survey is telling that as well. The Indeed.com online recruitment ads, the same trend slowing down. Yeah. I think in Europe, I would say that's going to happen as well. We see that, for instance, look at graduate recruitment. In the UK this year, it is actually at its worst level for many years. And it's 40% lower than the number of job graduate positions that apparently were available in 2018. So there are some signs of it not being as good an employment market as you think, actually, already.
Yeah. Have you got any sort of like things to sort of like potential landmines to avoid over the next month or to watch out for? We obviously had a positive one with Nvidia in between our sort of like, you know, transmissions with that was ballistic, the share price. But anything else you'd sort of like think to watch there, Chris?
I'd say watch the Japanese market. It's gone up a ton. It went vertical. Suspect it'll reverse sharply. And watch the amount of debt issuance you get out of the Treasury in the US, because they're going to issue $500 trillion of debt in the next few weeks. Yeah. That could be pretty interesting. Other landmines, let's not forget it's the summer season. you know. Andy Murray winning Wimbledon, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, Emma Raducanu coming back, not injured. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much again, gents, for your excellent insight. So I've got to call it there, you know, a day. But we've obviously got some good recurrent things. We've got AI and we've got the super cycle. We've got oil to talk about next time as well. So thanks very much, guys.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Thanks a lot, Chris. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.